Hello and welcome to another episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. This episode begins our coverage of the PDC course material. Tying into Tony's earlier question about animals, that's where I want to begin. And thankfully, this being a digital distribution, you can listen to this material in any order that you want to, so I'm going to go off a little track with this and then I'll start from the beginning with the next show. Animals are something that my wife and I have been talking about lately as we look to integrate them into our home site this year. And though we've done our best to attract in wild animals and provide a comfortable place for them to live and seek out food, now we want to bring in some animals that will stay with us and we will care for more directly. So it's something on my mind right now. For the case of this discussion, you're going to hear me use the word animal generically, and it's going to be a general term that includes insects, arachnids, fish, animals, and really most any creature that's out there, excluding things like plants, fungus, bacteria, or microscopic soil life. It casts a pretty wide net, but I'm using it as a catch-all for this episode. Also, I'm not going to push the ethics or principles of permaculture in this discussion so that you can use this information, including some of the questions I raise and the homework assignments, because, yes, there is more homework for you. But I'm doing that so that you can apply these ideas and come up with appropriate solutions for where you live. As you look at and think about these ideas, take all of it, mull it over, and find your own permaculture solution. I find that animals are important to our design because of their complexity. Though the number of benefits that we can get from plants are many, their generally static nature limits the influence they can have over others, and therefore the number of beneficial connections that they can raise. Our animals move, and we can guide that movement, should we so desire, and with that increase the ways in which they can interact with other elements of a design. Before I get into any depth of consideration of whether or not to include something in my design, the first question I ask is whether or not I'm including it for me personally because I want it to be there for some reason, or because it's there for the design itself. And if it's more for me because I have a desire to include it for whatever reason, I want to ensure that it really does fit what I'm trying to accomplish and I'm not forcing that choice. I know that it's easy to look at what's happening in backcast and justify that what's been done is permaculture, but I want to be honest about this and answer the why from the beginning so that my design is intentional and that everything within it is truly a proper fit. And once that decision's been made to include something, then comes the work to determine whether or not it's appropriate for the situation. There are times when, either because of the design itself or our own abilities, the answer to the question of appropriateness is going to be no, and we need to move on to something else and not include that, regardless of how much we may want to. Don't try to force it. You're going to wind up creating more work for yourself later from the feedback that you get and where you need to tighten things up so that they work better. When it comes to considering animals, there are 6 points that I want to touch on, and they are needs and requirements, yields, placement in a system, forage and grazing systems, forage species, and fencing requirements. As each of these are areas that you could spend a lot of time studying, and this is just a beginning overview of all this, I'm going to touch on different ones to varying degrees, and I'll include some links to outside resources for you to check for more information. And those will be in the show notes. And though I've had success inviting animals into my property, my knowledge of this subject isn't as broad or direct as many others, as I only have limited first-hand experience with it. So you're going to want to use your own experience, knowledge from a PDC, and your research to fill out this information. I'm reminded of my one instructor from the My PDC, Dylan, and how he continually reminded us that it's okay to say that we don't know, or that we need to do more research, or find more information. Even experts are going to be stumped from time to time, and being a permaculture practitioner requires you to be a generalist. Even if you focus in one or two areas, the amount of information that you process and use in permaculture design is very, very broad, and there's too much for one of us to know everything about it, and that's okay. I know that much of my focus is on Zone 0 and Zone 1 and on food plants, especially now that spring has sprung upon us here in the eastern United States and my garden's calling to me. So understand where your strengths are, use them, and accept when you don't know everything about everything, and that's okay too. When it comes to animals, one of the things that we're going to need to know about are their needs and requirements so that they can be healthy and productive within our design. And because I look at the world from the mindset of an analyst and someone who crunches a lot of information and data. That leads to numerous questions on my part, probably too many sometimes, but here's a set of questions that I work through when deciding on whether or not to include something into a system, along with some of the thoughts that go along with it. And the first one is, what type of food does my animal need? And with that, is it something that I can grow and provide, or does it need to come from an external input that can't be produced on site? And from there, why can't it be produced on site? Is it something rare and exotic? Or is it just that I haven't reached the point in my own production that there's enough in the design to care for it? And if it can't be provided locally, am I likely to look for something else unless there's a way to change that in the future? And if I need to get it in production to my own site, how long is that going to take? And does its food requirements change throughout the year? And this is with beekeeping. I run across a number of articles that talk about supplementing bees during the winter. Is that something that I'm going to have to do? Or, like what I'm doing with birds on my property, though many of them are normally insect eaters, they eat seeds throughout the winter to get them to the spring and the buffet of insects that come with it. Or something else to consider about food and on-site production is, as part of our feedback, if we have an animal, say chickens, and we want to make sure that they're getting bugs as a high-quality protein source, what if those aren't available because the chickens themselves are overgrazing? Do you need to adjust your numbers then, or provide a means to increase the amount of food? How are you going to provide food? And this could include not only feeders that you set up to put food in, but also whether it will come from forage that the animals can get to themselves. And if so, again, how are you going to grow that and do on-site production of it? And these all lead to a need to look for and see if we can build those self-maintaining feedback loops in our system to minimize the intervention on our part and make the inclusion of our animals more self-sufficient that they can tend for themselves. Also, when it comes to shelter, are there any particular requirements that need to be made, whether for the animal directly or because of laws? This comes to mind because of the work that I've been doing on beehives, and know that our local laws here influence what we're allowed to have for a hive. Pennsylvania specifically requires you to have a hive with removable frames so that they can be inspected, because you have to register your beehives, your apiary, with the state and pay a licensing fee every year. Or no, it's a licensing fee every 2 years, and then your hives are inspected regularly. So that limits me to Langstroth, Tottboer, or Warr-style hives, so that when an inspector comes by, they can actually get to the comb and see if there's any kind of disease or mite issues. Similarly, after combing through numerous ordinances on chickens lately because of what we're trying to do with urban agriculture in Harrisburg, different areas have different requirements for what you're allowed to build, including fully enclosed coops and runs, or others that are elevated off the ground so that the chickens can't get to the ground directly. There are also siting requirements for where chicken coops can go. Here in my own township, a chicken coop has to be at least 100 yards from any residential property line, or from a well or any kind of a waterway, and that can really, really restrict where you can put a coop or store the manure from the chickens. And trying to find out whether or not composting chicken manure counts as a storage space until it's finished. Well, how does that affect how you're going to handle those wastes? But furthermore, on the needs of your animal, what kind of companionship should you have for them? Meaning, are they social animals that exist best if there are multiples of their own kind, or if there's some other kind of animal that's around that could fill the role? And though I'm no shepherd, when researching sheep for my own PDC, I ran across several things that said that sheep are best raised in groups of four or more to meet their social requirements so that they can have a sane, healthy life. And though this ties into fencing requirements, having a knowledge of your local predators is also important, because that gives you an idea of what protection you need to include for your animals. Around here we have possums and raccoons, both of which will eat chickens and their eggs. So if the chickens are going to be in a coop overnight, that means that it needs to be very strong, with good latch systems and heavy gauge wire that predators can't chew through or to dig under and get at them. So you may need to have a wire floor on the bottom of your coop or your chicken runs if they're going to be out, and in order to keep predators away. Or, if they're roosting outside, a way to provide them a comfortable roost that's also going to keep them away from predators. One example I saw of that was to use a pair of upright metal pipes that can't be climbed by most predators, with a rough bar running between them, such as a branch from a tree, that your chickens can hop up to, but predators can't climb up to get at them. And I mean, another thing that we have around here also as potential predators are hawks and birds of prey, which might snatch up one of our chickens. So if they're going to be out and we want to keep them protected, then the runs are going to need to be enclosed or to cover the top of a garden area if it's fenced in, and we're going to let the chickens run through there. But that's some of the potential questions that I think about when looking at including animals in a system. And as I go through those and find out more information about different needs, then that expands on the questions. That's generally where I start. And that also leads us to homework assignment number one. I'd like you to think of an animal, and it can be any animal that you might want to include in your design or your home site. Research its requirements and what it would need in order to exist in the system where you are, whether that's a city apartment or an expansive rural area. And write all this information down, collect it together, say in your observation notebook, and begin thinking about your animal and its needs and requirements and how it would fit into your system. So then as you go through these other points that I'm going to touch on and the additional homework, it's all in one place for you to refer back to later. That brings us to point number two, animal yields. Looking at animal yields goes back to an earlier statement that I made before that we could easily spend the rest of this show, this podcast as a whole, looking at an item, brainstorming it, and discovering the yields that it can produce. And that applies equally here when we're talking about animals and everything that I said before on looking for yields. Now, I look for how animals are going to benefit the system on the large scale, as well as individual elements. What role are they going to fill within the system? Do they provide food, fuel, or fiber, or support to other items that do? And because I love to eat, and sometimes that shows on my waistline, especially during the winter months, one of the first things that I always think about is how an animal can provide food directly through things like eggs, milk, or meat, which can often be plentiful. But even if you don't eat these things, there are other benefits that you can gain from knowing about what yields an animal has and how they can help you in your system by including them. Animals are a part of nature, so we need to include them into our design in some way or another, whether that's purposefully raising them or introducing in wild animals and providing them habitat and shelter. They need to be there, regardless of what your views may be on domesticating animals or anything else. They need to be there. And I think that looking at non-primary yields for human beings, those food, fuel, and fiber, make it easier for those who would choose not to raise animals for food. It's like ducks. They're an excellent way to control slugs, and in return they provide manure for your garden and increase fertility, and they can also go around doing some weeding for you. Chickens will eat a wide range of pests, scratch the soil surface for you, which can prepare it for planting. And I mean, just those two simple ones, you add manure produced from the chicken to that, the litter that you can compost from their coop, and just the fun of having them around. And you can quickly begin to understand why chickens are omnipresent in permaculture discussions, especially the idea of a mobile chicken tractor or movable chicken runs. Or you could have a cow, if you have enough space, and use its dung as fertilizer to grow some types of mushrooms, or as a building material, or you can dry it and use it as a fuel. And these last two, as building material and fuel, I think are ones that could be very, very important as a resource in the future as we try to build on an extremely local level, particularly in a world where we have to consider energy descent. And those are just a couple, the duck, the chicken, the cow. And I try to limit this because I could go on and on and on about yields. They're something that are simple to me that I enjoy brainstorming about, but I want to get you thinking about some of those on your own. And that leads to homework assignment number two. Take that animal that you identified for homework number one for needs and requirements, and now think of all the yields that that animal can provide. Look at the ones that are directly useful for humans as a primary yield, but also work through secondary and even tertiary yields that come from that animal, and the way that it can benefit other elements within your system. And look for those connections and build them. Draw out your mind map, make lists, and just let your brain go crazy. And then as you do that, also remember that you can keep thinking about yields for days and days and days, and you'll continue to come up with more and more. And that's okay. Just work on it and get your mind flowing about this so that as you begin to do more and more design, you have a better idea of what to look for so that this process is quicker and quicker for you. So, We now understand what an animal is going to need. Where should it go in the system? Where do you want to place it? The easy and, I feel, somewhat contrived answer for that is where they will do the most good. But that doesn't really take into consideration why a given location is best, or some of the vectors that an animal has that need to be accounted for, or how often you're going to be able to or need to tend to that animal. We can't just throw animals into the design and hope it's going to work. You know, I can't go out, buy some chickens, throw them in the yard, and go, hey guys, have at, and think that it's going to be as productive as it could be by intentionally designing how they're going to fit, where they can be placed so that they can be easily tended to, preferably in a way that is more self-sustaining so that it minimizes our need to take action, all while providing yields that we can use. If they need to be tended to regularly, for whatever reason, say visits of every other day or less, then they should probably be near zone zero, in zone one or two, where we can get to them quickly and easily. And depending on their shelter requirements, even if you don't need to be in heavy contact, you may want to place them close at hand out of necessity. My worm bin for vermiculture comes to mind as I say that. Though I only need to feed the worms every couple of days as I collect my kitchen scraps between what's going to go in my outside compost and what's going to go to the worms, the outside conditions would be rather harsh on them because we have a wide range of temperature here where I live, being in the single digits Fahrenheit and some rare occasions below 0 Fahrenheit during the winter, to upwards of 100 degrees or a few more during the summer. The outside just isn't a stable place for worms, so keeping them in my home for zone zero makes a stable environment that's easy to get to. Plus, I can grab that bin, throw it in the back of my car to take it if I'm doing a demonstration of vermiculture to show other people, or to bring it upstairs to let my daughter work through. The location, the size, all of it works best for those worms to be in my home. And to build self-sufficiency for our animals, the needs and requirements that we established before when looking at what we were going to include should be used as we develop that location so that the animals have access to what they need as they need it in such a way that it continues to increase the number of beneficial connections with the other elements in our design. Now, this doesn't mean that we don't have any interaction with them or leave them alone, again, just to reduce our need to do so by placing forage plants within their pen or having forage materials available that we can quickly harvest and give to them as needed, or foods that can be easily processed and stored for the winter as supplement as needed. And I also mentioned vectors because some animals can be destructive to our needs if they're left to roam freely throughout a property. One thing that comes to mind is Doug Fine's book, Farewell My Subaru, and the amount of damage that his two particularly persistent and hungry goats were able to do in a very short amount of time, and the efforts that he went through to control that. But once we have some controls in place, they can live well and we can reap the benefits of their yields. In Doug's case, that was some high fat milk from his goats in order to make goat milk ice cream. And another thing that we talked about in my PDC when it comes to the damage from animals, which we covered twice, both as part of riparian repair and the general discussion on animals, is about not letting livestock wander down to streams to drink because of how quickly they contaminate the water with their feces and also the damage that they can do to the riverbank by walking around in that mix of mud and soil where the water and earth meet. So taking those ideas of location and benefits and repair and self-sufficiency is homework assignment 3. Using your sample animal, sketch out your design site, mark where you would place that animal to do the most good. Make a couple notes on the page about why that's the best location. What does it mitigate by being there? What are the benefits that it provides? How can you make the most use of your animal's yields? And now, forage and grazing systems. This is the way that we provide food to our animals. Like so many of the things that we cover in permaculture as an integrative design system, how we do this depends on all the information that you collect and all the points as part of this discussion, all the principles, all the ethics, because it all does interrelate. And this is also a topic that I'm not real familiar with because I've never managed any amount of livestock before. It was one thing to have a pen out for an animal so that they could run around outside, or providing some kind of a leash and chain run or something like that. But even if I were to have had knowledge of that and were to do so, I can't imagine having a large scale for livestock because it's beyond the scope of my personal work. So any shortcomings in this discussion are mine. But forage is the food available to our animals and may include things that already exist in the system we're using, are ones that we intentionally plant as part of our plan, or are the result of succession from earlier choices in the way that the land was used. Ideally, we want to be matching the food to the needs of the animals throughout the year, and I'll be talking about forage species in the next section. But it may result in direct feeding and supplementation of food, or the way that we use our grazing system to get animals to the feed that they need. And when it comes to grazing systems, the different types that you run across depend on who's writing about it and how they decide to distinguish various pieces of information. And that's just what I've learned and distilled from my research. And because of that, I'm going to try to provide three basic ideas of stocking and grazing systems, and then about how those are modified into more specific uses. But the three types of rotation or grazing are set or continuous grazing, paddock or rotational grazing, and strip grazing. Set or continuous grazing is where you have one group of animals that is placed on one piece of land and remain there throughout the season. And it doesn't require intensive management, but it does require a low stocking rate so that you don't deplete or destroy the land. Just think about the difference between 10 acres of land for 10 sheep versus a quarter of an acre of land for 10 sheep, and the amount of impact that that's going to have on the amount of food that they have and what happens to the landscape. So then you also have paddock or rotational grazing, and this is when a group of animals has access to a large number of paddocks or grazing fields and are moved through them. And this can happen on a short rotation where the animals are moved through the same area several times in a season once the forage food has regenerated, or a long rotation where it may be a number of fields such that it takes several years before the same one is used by that group of animals again. And this depends on the size of the land, the number of paddocks or fields, and again, the stocking rate of the animals. One thing that I ran across was a short rotation where they may spend as little as one day on a field, but there may be 30 or 40 fields. So they spend one day here, or move to the next, or move to the next, or move to the next, continuously through this cycle. And the last one that I found is strip grazing. And this is where animals are moved regularly, perhaps every few days or every day, and that the area that they're allowed to be in is determined by a portable, usually electric fence. From what I ran across, that seems to be popular with dairy cattle and can be very important in the spring because you can move animals onto an area where there's a lot of lush, emergent growth and have them get in, eat there, control that through the spring, and then move them to a paddock or rotational grazing system later in the year. And all of these three, as I identify them, primary types of grazing systems can be modified very much based on the way that animals are moved through the system, how often they're moved through the system, the amount of time that they spend on any particular area, what your stocking rates are, whether they're high or low. Also, what types of animals are you rotating through the system? Are you rotating multiple animals through your system? And I mentioned that because of an example that was given to me by Dylan, again, during my PDC. And that was a system that rotated cows, sheep, chickens, and pigs through the same fields. The cows went in first when the grass was long because they tend only to eat the upper section of the grass, the top. So they would go through, eat the tops. Once it became fairly groomed, they'd be moved on to the next field, and then sheep would be let in because they mow the grass fairly short. They go in, mow the grass, they get moved to the next field. Now that the grass is very short, bugs can proliferate, exposure to the sun, grass starts to come up, you let the chickens in. They're going to scratch the earth, prepare it, let some of those seeds see the sun, eat all the bugs up, do some weeding. They get moved out back to where they regularly live, and then the pigs follow up that system because they're going to root at the ground and move it and then till it as they go after the roots and their preferred foods. Turns all that soil over, allows seeds that were buried or dormant to get to the surface, succession begins again, the field proliferates, and sometime thereafter you can introduce your cows back in on and continue the system again. And something that I'm considering to try with bees as a way to build a forage system for them that also directs them where they'll do the most good as pollinators is to place nectary plants that bloom at specific times in particular places throughout my field and gardens so that the bees are moved without having to move the hive because of how much just moving a hive can disrupt the bees. It's also often been related to me that when you move a hive that it should be less than 3 feet or more than 3 miles because of the way that bees familiarize themselves with their hive location. And to do a change that's more than 3 feet but less than 3 miles can make it difficult for them to find their way home. This idea that I have is similar to what I'm doing with keeping birds attracted to my home by feeding them through the winter so that they're available in the spring to eat pests. That with the bees, I plant nectary plants that bloom very early in the spring to begin feeding them and keeping them near my site, and then move that blooming cycle further and further away from the hive, leading them then to zone 1 and zone 2 garden areas, so that my attracting plants are there during the same time that my foods begin to flower. And this is just an experiment that I want to run. I don't know how it's going to work, how intensive it's going to be to design and lay out this kind of an experiment. But if you've heard of anybody doing this, please let me know so I can see what their results were like. If this is something you've tried and it's been successful or not, please let me know. I know that the potential for failure with this is pretty high, but I want to find out if something like this could work, and experimenting with such a system is just fascinating with me. What can I say? I love this stuff. But that's going to put us to homework assignment number 4. Using your example animal from the previous assignments, devise a forage and grazing system for them. Just how you would consider moving them through your design and provide them with enough food at the same time. Which leads us to foraging systems. And that leads us to forage species. Our forage species are the specific foods that provide for an animal. As we want to try to grow this ourselves on site, it will need to be available throughout the year, either fresh or in a way that we can easily manage for seasonal storage. What constitutes forage will depend on your animal, but researching its needs should lead you to have a pretty good idea of what it's going to be. There shouldn't really be that many surprises once you've researched the needs and requirements of the animal. But if something happens that you didn't really run across a lot of this, go out and look for some more information specifically about what your animal eats. Or if you have somebody who you know that's already raising these types of animals, go talk to them. Have a look at what they're doing. Get an idea of what it is. Because once you have that thought of what it is they require, then you can look on how you want to provide it. For animals that eat vegetables, will you grow them their own food specifically or provide scraps from your own table? Do you have a way to produce additional insects should your natural supply run short for chickens or ducks? For those of us who are in temperate climates or have a harsh winter, what are you going to do over the winter? Or if weather turns bad, can you provide drought-resistant crops or ones that can survive seasonal inundation if you have flooding? If you've done your zone, sector, and vector analysis for where you are, you can use that as a starting place to determine what some of your risks are for providing food stock and how you can mitigate issues. Again, use your creativity and look to what you can do with what you have, rather than needing to go out and buy something or introduce something that you're not going to be able to sustain with your own abilities. I've mentioned my backyard birds many, many times, and the bird seed that I provide for them over the winter is an example of a seasonal store that I want to try to provide. Yes, I can go out and buy it, but I may be able to do more here with my own resources. And having watched the birds over the winter, though the number of species that have come in between the two different types of woodpeckers, the chickadees, the nuthatches, finches, and everything else, the foods that they eat, though varied, 90% of their needs are met by suet cakes and sunflower seeds. Most of the mixed stuff that comes in the general bags of food that I've gotten, like cracked corn and millet, don't really get touched. The sunflower seeds and the suet are going to get picked first. So because of that, I know that the two things for me to focus my attention to do the most good are on growing some sunflowers and providing suet. Well, looking at that, the sunflowers, pretty straightforward, easy to do. But the suet can be substituted by using peanut butter, which is something we've done in the past and was eaten fairly quickly. And though I can't grow it, it's usually something that we have on hand. And the suet is something that I can provide or substitute for. I can provide it because of some of the foods that I eat. Having suet, I just need to melt it down and pour it into blocks. Or the animal fat that comes from cooking meat, be that pork or beef or chicken, That fat that comes off can be strained, heated till it's melted, poured into a mold, and be placed out for the birds to use. So, homework assignment number 5. What forage species would you grow in order to support your example animal from the other homework assignments? Is it something that you can grow and provide enough of to meet all of its needs, or is there something else that you can look for that will meet that need that you can grow? To help you with this one, I've included a link in the show notes to a forage species website provided by Oregon State University. I like it. There's a lot of information out there, huge list of plants available, and is a place that you can poke around and do some research in. And that brings us to the last point to consider. Fencing is needed not only to protect the animal from other things that could harm it, as I mentioned above, but also to keep it away from things that it could harm. It goes without saying this, but how you fence, what fence you use, all depends on what you're trying to accomplish with your fencing. You know, how are you going to install it? What posts are you going to use? Is a wire fence enough? Does it need to be a mesh fence? Depending on your predators, that determines the thickness of wire that you might need to use, say if you're trying to keep them away from your chickens. If you have a neighbor's dog that likes to dig, or your own dog that likes to dig and get into areas, then that how deep you have to extend your fence below the ground level is going to change. Any trip to your DIY or garden center and look to fencing will provide you with a myriad of options on how to install it, what to install, how fine or wide the mesh is, whether you're using metal or plastic or wood. The options for fencing are many, and I've only done the lightest of fencing to help direct some people to different areas. I've never tried to keep animals out of my garden, and the suggestions for what you need and where it will go are many. And I'll include links in the show notes for different fencing options so you can go take a look. Again, fencing, not something I've had to do a lot of, but something that you'll need to think about based on your own needs, especially as you build forage and grazing systems for your animals. Which leads to homework question number 6. What would the fencing requirements of your example animal from the previous homework assignments be? Does it have any? Or if you're deciding to raise a small animal or maybe some insects in your home, what would you use to house it? And how does that affect your choices? So, with that, brings those sections to a close. Before I wrap up this episode, I want to give you a recap of the homework assignment for you and bring all 6 of them together. Think of an animal. Any animal that you might want to include in your design, and take some time and research its requirements and what it needs in order to exist in your system, wherever that's going to be. Use those needs and requirements and think of those as your inputs to your animal. Well, what are the outputs going to be? The yields that it's going to provide? Particularly, which ones meet human needs? And how can you take those and move from the primary to the secondary and the tertiary? And look at also what other elements it's going to support and how. Sketch out your design site. Mark where you're going to place that animal, where it can do the most good. Make a couple of notes on how exactly it's going to accomplish that. Using that sketch, devise a forage and grazing system for the animal. List the forage species that you're going to use and why. How they meet the animal's food requirements. Include those forage species in the sketch as you're making it. Also, where it's going to get its water. If you need to put out a food dish for supplementation, where's that going to go? Describe your fencing requirements, whatever they may be, and include them on the sketch, if necessary. And if you need to provide any special housing, such as a beehive, a chicken coop, worm composting bin, what would it be and where would you locate it? And now that you have all this information and the homework assignments that go with it, go out there and do the work. Research all this, put it together, put it in your observation notebook. Now that you've done it, does it change your point of view at all, or how you would go about including an animal in your design? Got all that together? Good. If you can, put it all together in a document and email it to me so I can take a look at what you found. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Or if you want, post it in the comments of the show. Whatever you do, I'd like to hear what you find out. Not only will it help me with my practice, but also it'll help the other folks listening to the show. So please consider sharing it. And if you find this episode or any others helpful, please consider making a donation at thepermaculturepodcast.com. There's a button on the right-hand side of the main page that will take you to PayPal, which is fairly quick and easy. But if that's not a service that you like, contact me and I can provide you other ways to help the show. And that's going to bring this episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann to a close. Thank you for joining me again. The next episode, which I'll have out in a couple of days, will continue covering the PDC material in depth. I'm going to keep rolling through that until I've covered all of it. From time to time, I'll intermix some listener question shows, but we'll just keep rolling with the PDC until it's done. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.